Continuing in mitzvah, Reish Nun Zayin 257, the mitzvah to honor wise people, which we saw last time, extends also towards elderly people. But the main mitzvah is specifically people who are learned in the Torah. It's just that the reason you have to stand up for people who are just generally elderly is because we assume that they've at least gained some wisdom that's applicable to Torah subjects, to the worship of God during their long lifetime, so we have to honor them as well. But the main mitzvah is, in fact, to stand up for those who have learned much Torah. Midini ha-mitzvah, ma-sham, zirchanim lefracha lechaz, are as follows, she'ein tzarech lomar, lemi she'einu chacham, chaya b'chod ha-chacham. That you might think that the mitzvah to honor a wise person applies only to someone unwise. Ela afilu ha-chacham, chaya b'chod ha-chacham. That even a wise person must honor another wise person. The Gemara relates that in Babel, in Babylonia, all the different students, even though they were very wise already, they would all still stand up for each other. So you see that even somebody who is wise in his own right has to stand up for someone else who is, in fact, wise. However, if it's somebody standing up for someone slightly below their status, even though it's someone that you might want to honor in some way, you don't have to stand up completely. You just, jump up a little bit. Just enough to show some sort of recognition of that person's status, but you still have to do something that indicates that you honor this person. So specifically when it relates a student and a Torah teacher, so there is a greater level of honor that he has to accord this person than any other wise person in the world. That we know this famous statement in Pirkei Avos says that the fear of your teacher should be like your fear of heaven. So you really have to go to great lengths to show appropriate honor for your Torah teacher. And we'll see exactly what that's talking about in a few minutes. So Viveir Amru Aviv Rabo, Rabo Kodem Bekavod Uvavedo Vemaso Vishviya. So if you have your Torah teacher and you have your father, so your Torah teacher takes precedence regarding honor and returning a lost object and helping him with a burden and redeeming him from captivity. But if your father was a wise person, even if he wasn't really your Torah teacher, he's not as wise as your Torah teacher, Aviv Kodim. So if you, in other words, talking about your regular father, not particularly wise, not particularly learned, we're going against your Torah teacher, so your Torah teacher takes precedence in these areas. So in the Perek Chelek, the Hashkafic Perek of Sanhedrin, famous Perek Chelek, says that if you would disagree with your teacher, as if you disagree with the heavens, the divine presence, Shnemar, it's because the Torah says, Batsu Samal Hashem, the Dasan Vaviram, it doesn't say that they argued with, that they quarreled with Moshe, it says they quarreled with God. So since Moshe was their primary Torah teacher, so since they quarreled with him, as if they quarreled with God. Obviously, this doesn't apply to the idea that you're not allowed to disagree with your teacher at all. It means a public disagreement or an inappropriate disagreement. But if you have a slightly different shittas in halacha, because you have your proofs and your teacher has his proofs, you don't have to be a carbon copy of your teacher. That's not the way the Torah works. The Ramon, the Darkei Moshe, on the tour, points out that he brings from the Torah Trumas Hadeshin a heter that if you have proper proofs, then you're allowed to disagree with even your primary Torah teacher. But he says, what do you mean? You don't really need to have proofs for this idea, because the whole Torah, you look at the whole Mishnah, Gemara, everything, everybody is agreeing with their Torah teachers. They do it in a respectful way. That's part of Darka Shel Torah. That's the way the Torah works, that people disagree with each other all the time.
Given the different gradations of respect, you're supposed to show publicly to various other people, isn't there a problem of embarrassing, someone, in public by not, you only get up a little bit out of your chair for this one, and you get up way out for this one.
Yeah, if there will be a misunderstanding, so it's probably you could be machmer on yourself. But the idea most of the time is that you're going to understand that there's going to be an understanding of exactly what the proper social grace is over here. But you're right, maybe it's not, sometimes there could be misunderstandings, but I feel like in the olden days there were much clearer gradations. Now you have people who think that they're bigger chachamim than they really are. Maybe there's more honesty in the olden days. That's a good question. Mashamar zichrono livracha b'moras rabo shelo yeshe b'mekomo v'liachria dvarav v'lo yistar dvarav. That you shouldn't sit in his place. So the rabbi has a special chair in the shir room, in the base medrash, or wherever. And you shouldn't say, not only lo yistar dvarav, that you shouldn't say, you know, when he's giving shir, you shouldn't say, Rebbe, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, that's incorrect. You can't even say, oh, yes, that's correct. That's 100% correct. You're not allowed to say that because it shows, like, you're the authority. You're the one who decides whether the Rebbe is correct or not. You can't say that. You could say it in a more respectful way that, you know, oh, well, Rebbe, I think you could bring in additional proof for this from whatever, but you can't present it as if the Rebbe is only correct because you're deciding or you're stating that he's correct. The lo yo Rebbe fun of Leolam, the same thing, too. You, in the course of a shir, it's not like you're not allowed to bring counterproofs to what the Rebbe is saying, but you shouldn't say, no, that's wrong. That's not correct. Below your Rebbe fun of Leolam, you're not allowed to deliver halachic rulings in his presence ever. Vafilu toch shneimasar mil imo asr lahorus. And even within the span, the radius of shneimasar mil, of 12 mil, you're not allowed to issue halachic rulings. But beyond that point, then you're allowed to do it only on a temporary basis. You're not allowed to set up shop and, you know, put a sign outside your door saying "More hara," you know, I'm going to give you hara if you come to me. But if somebody asks you a question, then you're allowed to answer outside the 12 mil radius. So the Oskim point out that it doesn't talk. It's not talking about over here something pashut. It's talking about something where it's as if you're giving a chiddush. So, for example, if you're within the same city, within the same 12 mil as your rebbe, and somebody asks you, you know, I cooked a fleishik soup in a milchik pot that hadn't been used for the previous 24 hours. Is the fleishik soup kosher or not? So everybody knows that's a simple din. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's okay. So there's nothing. It's not a hora. Hora means there has to be some type of chiddush. We have this principle also that we have midas chasidus found in the Gemara and Chulin based on what Yechezkel did. Yechezkel Hanavi. That the pasuk says that he didn't eat nevelo treifa. So what do you mean he didn't eat nevelo treifa? He was Jewish, of course he didn't eat nevelo treifa. So the answer is that he wouldn't eat from behema shehora b'chacham. There's apparently a midas chasidus that the Gemara brings, a pious practice that you shouldn't eat from an animal that a halachic authority had to rule to be kosher. In other words, if it wasn't just obvious that it was kosher right away, so if he had to rule that its kosher status depended on a halachic ruling, what do you mean?
Well,
this is a different standard. Oh. It's that the people are trained to figure it out. Mm-hmm. You mean non-glot?
I'm saying, in other words, right. In other words, something which is non-glot. In other words, yeah. The idea being that it's a mitzvah to have something where you didn't have to even worry about it because there was no sreif at all.
Well, not exactly because of what I'm about to tell you. Whereas obviously the poskim point out that this doesn't apply to, let's say, you have a person who knows how to shecht, but he doesn't know all the dinim of treifas. So he finds something in the animal that, oh, I don't know whether this is a treifa or not. You take it to a chacham, and the chacham says, no, that's fine, that's not a treifa. That's not a behema shehora b'chacham. Just because a rabbi had to pronounce about it, you know, that doesn't make it a behema shehora b'chacham. It has to be the rabbi, you know, figured out what the din was based on his ruling. And just if the person asking the questions didn't know a basic halacha, that's not a behema shehora b'chacham. So the same thing applies over here, that if somebody asks the student, just a basic halacha that most people know off the bat, he didn't have to use his learning to figure out the answer. Then that would not apply. That's not a hora. Then that a student would be allowed to give that answer. If somebody asks you, the YU based medrash, if somebody walks in and asks one of the students, you know, what's the bracha on a candy? So it's what the student has to say, you know, go ask Rav Schechter. He's sitting in the front over there. I'm not allowed to answer. I'm not allowed to answer now. No, you're allowed to say it's chakal. Everybody knows that the blessing on the candy is chakal. Right, but it's a pasha thing. It doesn't require somebody comes in and says, you know, Rahman Atlan, you know, my relative is on a ventilator. This is the exact situation. You know, are we allowed to pull the plug?
Then
that's not something you can answer. But if it's something that's a pasha halacha, then you would be allowed to answer this. So, well, let's say the student sees the Rebbe violating something, the principle that's found in the Torah. So how do you prevent him from sinning? So you say, what do you say? Rebbe, didn't you teach us that this thing is forbidden? So again, you shouldn't just say, you know, if he's about to take a bite of a ham sandwich, you don't go over and you whack it out of his hand and, you know, spit on him. How could you do such a thing? But you just say, Rebbe, I don't know, maybe you want to take a second look at that sandwich. I believe that maybe something about it is something you told us once is not proper to eat. But if there's no other way, let's say he's continuing to do it anyway, then yeah, you are allowed to rip it out of his hand, not spit on him. That was a little excessive, but you are allowed to do something embarrassing, because when there's a Chil Hashem involved, when there's an issue, there's a balance between Kvod Shamayim and Kvod Harav, so God's honor, so to speak, takes precedence, and you would be, if there's no other way, then you would be allowed to prevent him from sinning in a manner that would ordinarily be considered to be embarrassing. Ve'achiluk shebein rabo muva kolomar sherov chachmaso mimenu l'rabo she'ein rov chachmaso mimenu. Ah, this is very important. So there's a principle in halacha called a rav muvak, or what we call in colloquial terminology, a rebbe muvak. So what's a rebbe muvak? A rebbe muvak is your primary Torah teacher. So what's your primary Torah teacher? So you have all these students of Rav Soloveitchik, who I say, oh, I'm a Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik, he was my Rebbe Muvak. So it's somewhat questionable as to whether even somebody who's it was so aduk, so connected, so dependent on any particular rabbi nowadays really has the status of a Talmud to a Rebbe Muvak type of relationship. Because nowadays, most of the time people learn by themselves. They absorb information from books. In the olden days, 2,000 years ago, you would sit in the shir all day long, and the Rebbe would be explaining to you orally, all telling you all the principles of the Torah. You have the Torah Shebichsav, and they'd be darshaning all the time, Torah Shebalpeh. But nowadays, most of the time is spent learning by yourself from books. And then the Rebbe, you go to the shir from the Rebbe, or you ask the Rebbe questions, and he tells you how to figure everything out, what the proper process to apply is. You know, if you have a question about a seeming contradiction, he resolves it for you. So even though your main approach in life may be from this Rebbe, and he was your primary Torah teacher in the sense of compared to other Torah teachers that you have, it's not so clear that most of the time nowadays that we can actually have the status of a Rebbe Muvak. Again, there's no problem being Machmer if you want to, you know, so you feel very, very indebted. You really feel that one of your teachers stands out over the other. So you could be, in a case where it doesn't result in a kula, you couldn't be machmer to consider that person your Rebbe Muvak. But, for example, we had those things where it said before, where we have the conflict between your father's needs and your teacher's needs. So really that only applies by a Rebbe Muvak. And standing also, you have to stand up. A Rebbe Muvak, you have to stand up completely as soon as he comes into your view. So with a regular chacham, so you just have to stand up when he's in your Arba Amos.
There's a similar consideration apply geographically, shall we say. We talk about, you know, so many million, you know, you're not allowed to paskin, but you know, now, right. Basically, you know, I mean, you know, the whole halachic world is...
you could just send the big rabbi an email, so maybe you're not allowed to paskin anywhere.
Yeah, right. You know, I mean...
Yeah. Right. But nowadays, we don't really have Rebbe Muvak anyway, so really... in other words, even in the olden days when there was Rebbe Muvak, so once the Rebbe Muvak gave the student Rishus to Paskin, so then that was okay. All these things are subject to Rishus. You know, in general, we have Chacham. It's not a Mechila al HaKavod per se, but even when, even in general, when the Rebbe wants to not necessarily be so makbid on his honor, so he's allowed to be Mochel on all the Kavod. You're not allowed to be Mochel, by the way, on the Bizayon. That's one thing you have to know. You can be Mochel on the Kavod, but if something would be considered to be a Bizayon, so maybe he wants to be Mochel that you don't have to stand up completely, or that you don't have to stand up completely when you foresee him, only when you come into the Arba Amos, so he could do that. But if something is a bizarre, like he says to his students, I want you to call me by my first name, without adding Rebbe to it, so then that would not be allowed. The rabbi doesn't have the permission to be mochel on his kavod to such an extent that it creates a bizayon. So you have to judge in any individual circumstance whether it's a bizayon or not. So nowadays we have an institutionalized rishus, which is called smicha. That in the olden days, when the Talmud was higia lahora, when he got to the point where he was capable of deciding halachic questions, so the rabbi, if he had a Rebbe Muvak, so Rebbe Muvak would give him rishus to go out and do it. And if he didn't have a Rebbe Muvak, so he was just recognized as higia lahora, that he was now capable of deciding halachic questions, meaning that if anybody asked him in any area of the Torah what the din was, he would be able to answer. Then he would go ahead and become a more hora'ah. So nowadays, the Rama has a whole essay in the Darkei Moshe on the tour, talking about what is exactly is smicha nowadays. It says basically it's just a communal standard, that nowadays there's so much confusion about who's acceptable and who's not, that you want to have an institutionalized thing. Like we also have Kabbalah for shochtim. In the olden days, whoever knew shechita would shecht. But nowadays, you're not allowed to shecht unless you get a Kabbalah, unless you have an authorization. The Ramah says that some communities instituted this also by being Mesader Gittin, and maybe even Kiddushin. That if you, since there's so many complex halachos with Gittin, and there's so many potential pitfalls that could come if you don't do it properly, that you don't be Mesader Gittin, you don't arrange for the Gittin, you don't preside over, officiate over a get, unless you have officially been authorized by a recognized authority to do so, yeah?
About the shechting, would that be for the community or for yourself? I've heard of people who shechted their own chickens. There used to be a guy in this neighborhood.
And they didn't have a Kabbalah?
I have no idea. He probably did, but...
The takana nowadays really is that you don't shecht without supervision unless you have a Kabbalah, period. Okay. I think there's a whole discussion, maybe in the olden days, some communities, if you shall shecht it only for yourself, you didn't need it, because it was only if you were doing it for the community that you needed a Kabbalah. Sofrim also, of course. Topic near and dear to my heart. Then you don't. You're not a sofer unless you have a Kabbalah.
So in other words, the day before you got your smicha, if somebody asked you a shaila, you'd say wait until tomorrow or something like that. No. I mean that
depends on what the shaila is.
I mean,
I don't know. I mean, smicha nowadays is not right. It's not smicha nowadays. Is also not what it used to be in the olden days. That smicha nowadays doesn't really mean that you were hagia lahora. It means that you are. Not gonna, you know, that you're going to be able to come up with an answer by consulting the appropriate avenues, if you need to do so. But in the olden days, Gil Orel really meant that you could answer any question in Arba Chelkei Shulchan Aruch, in the entire Torah, on the spot. Which most people, even with smicha, vast majority, 99% of people with smicha, cannot necessarily do. So, you're right. So again, if it was a simple thing, so you're allowed to answer anyway. But if it's a real hora, then even with smicha, you're right. It's smicha is just in order to get an official position, so it's appropriate to have an official type of documentation.
It's like a PhD or something. You know? Doesn't mean you know anything.
I'll be
sorry.
All right.
Well, good thing your wife isn't here. But you're right, that exactly at the moment you get your smicha, so then you can answer shaylas, and before then not. You can't set up shop, I would say, as an official rabbi, but to answer simple questions, if you're known as somebody who can do so, I don't think we're so makpid on that. But smicha, you're right, that a lot of people who have smicha, who A, don't use it, and B, really shouldn't be having it, that they managed to pass the test somehow, but you have to be, nowadays, you have to be, look beyond the smicha, and you have to figure out. Unfortunately, we don't have an actual, it sort of defeated the purpose that smicha nowadays is so commonplace that just because someone has smicha, you can't consider that person to be a reliable halachic, not even authority, but some sort of source for halachic information. You really have to independently ascertain by speaking with the people who are universally recognized to be major halachic authorities, whether it's a person... whether any given person is, in fact, really qualified to issue halachic rulings or not. It's a big problem. The Gemara says that there are two bad things. There's a Talmud shehigia lehora ve'eno. There's a Talmud she'enu magia lehora umore. That's a student who sets up shop because he wants to be a rabbi and he wants to sit in the big fancy chairs and he wants to... you know, get all the honor and respect. So he sets up shop and he starts issuing halachic rulings. That's called Talmid Shelo Higia Lehoro Mora. And then there's another, so that's considered really bad. And then there's something that's also considered really bad, which is a Talmid Shehigia Lehoro Ve'eno Mora. Somebody who really is authorized to give halachic rulings and refrains from doing so. So that's also very bad because you leave all the work that people are not qualified for, potentially. And you could be of benefit to Klal Yisrael, and you don't do it. I would potentially add into this category that there are very great Talmidei Chachamim nowadays, maybe even some Rosh Yeshiva, who know the entire Shas, and they spend all their time, you know, doing the Lumdus, that they conceptually analyze the Shas over and over again, which is very nice, and they give shir to the Talmidim, and they don't, they really qualify, in terms of the knowledge, they are qualified to give halachic rulings, but they don't do so because they're busy with the other stuff. So that potentially is an issue of Talmud, the person who attains great Torah knowledge and doesn't put it to the use of Hora. They think that being a Rosh Yeshiva is more important than issuing halachic rulings. But that's not true. And the classic Jewish thought that the highest form of learning is Lasukei Shmaitza Liba Dehilchasa, that you use all your learning to figure out exactly what the way a person should behave in this world.
In other words,
The abstract analysis is useful if it really helps you come to more precise understanding of what the Torah is all about.
Yeah.
But yeah, in terms of in and of itself, going back and forth with a conception, you know, it's
way up there with the angels and just
So nowadays, in fact, there's a real the actual high level now is what's called a posek, and there's nobody gives a a certificate. So and so is declared a posek. It's something which is just
acknowledged. It's by acclamation. People ask you questions,
people think that what you're talking about, and they quote you, and they're willing to
So you're right. It really has sort of undermined the whole institution of smicha. I mean, I have smicha. Rav Shechter has smicha. We both have smicha, but obviously one is a greater Talmud Chacham than the other.
You're younger.
Right, there's no specific certification that he has that I don't have. You're right. So it is sort of reverted to the old way that it's sort of by acclamation. The issue of a Rebbe Muvak also when it comes to competing with the father is as follows. Nowadays most people don't have a Rebbe Muvak, so the lost object and the helping out and all these things of the Rebbe instead of the father would not apply. So nowadays your father, in fact, takes precedence with all these things. The Sefer HaChassidim brings another reason, which is quoted in the poskim, that even perhaps the Rebbe would take precedence nowadays if you had a Rebbe Muvak, because when the Rebbe Muvak took precedence, that's talking about the olden days. That, even great, great, great Torah scholars, they'd work for a few hours a day to make a living, and then the rest of the time they'd be learning, and then whoever wanted to learn from this person, would make an effort to get close to, maybe they give a class, maybe they'd study with this person, with a great Torah scholar, and the person would basically, the great scholar would give of his time for free to help the young students grow and become Torah scholars as well. So that's the type of Rebbe Muvak that I'm talking about. But nowadays, we have schools, and the father's paying the salary, paying the tuition to the school to pay for the salary of the teacher to teach the son Torah. So you don't have the svara anymore. The Rebbe normally takes precedence is the father brought him into Olam Hazeh, and the Rebbe takes him into Olam Haba.
So that's paying the Rebbe.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. So since nowadays the father pays the Rebbe, so really indirectly it's the father taking the son into Olam Haba as well. So therefore, nowadays it's possible that the father would take precedence even if you had a Rebbe Muvak situation.
Before we quite leave this area, what about the distinction that used to be between a Dayan and a Rosh Yeshiva?
What do you mean?
Well, for example, in Brisk, famously.
Was an unusual situation.
Oh, really? That was unusual.
You mean Reb Chaim and Reb Chazelik?
Yeah, right.
That was a very unique situation. Oh, okay. Normally, I mean, have it in Breuer's too, to a certain extent. Not exactly to the same extreme that you had it in Brisk, but Reb Chaim felt it was actually, Reb Chaim was known as a very conceptual person. He was the one who pioneered the Brisker approach of studying Torah. So this is, nowadays, been taken to more of an extreme, just working with concepts and analysis as opposed to getting down to earth, rolling up your sleeves and working out to what the halacha should be, what the correct understanding should be. So Reb Chaim felt, so part of that I mentioned before, so part of this approach that Reb Chaim initiated was he wanted to analyze all the shittas of the Rishonim. So in the classic approach, you've worked through the Gemara, you work through Rishonim, you work through the Acharonim, when you're trying to figure out the Halacha, and you try to figure out which approach is the correct one, based on proofs and analyzing the various merits of the different things. So Reb Chaim was very into concepts, very into understanding everything, so he could understand all the Shittas in the Rishonim. He felt that they all made perfect sense in their own way, just depending on they learned the Gemara in different ways. That's why his general approach, obviously there are some exceptions, it can't be machmer for literally everything, was basically that he tried to accommodate in practice all the shittas of the Rishonim. He tried to be machmer for that. So because of that, since he felt that he was, because of this approach of his, he wasn't necessarily the right person to be issuing halachic rulings, he thought that his role as the Rav of Brisk was that he was going to give good drushes and inspire the people to Torah observance, to greater Torah observance, and help people He said that the main job of the rabbi is really to help people, that all the struggling people he took under his wing, he made sure that they were provided for. That's what he viewed as his role as the Rav of Brisk. And then, so in order to answer the Shailas, they hired someone else, Reb Simcha Zelig Rieger.
His granddaughter is a member of...
So Reb Simcha Zelig was the Dayan, and he answered the Shailas, and he was a classical Posek. He wasn't a brisker person. I mean, he was a Talmud of Reb Chaim. He learned that way also, but in terms of the deciding of the halacha, he was normal. Very normal, and he did. He was not necessarily so machmir even all the time. There's a famous story. So Reb Chaim also, because of this reason, sometimes when he just needed a psak, so there was some issue. I forget exactly what the issue was, where he wrote to Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was considered to be the posek hador at the time in Kovna, and he said he has a very difficult issue. He said, I'm sending you the Shaila, just send me the psak. Just send me your psak. Don't tell me the reasons. Because if you start telling me the reasons, so I'm going to think, oh, well, what about this? And what about this? And I'm going to start second guessing it. So just tell me the reasons. So at one point, also, they said to Reb Chaim, we have a Dayan also, but you really need to pull your weight more in terms of answering the Shailas. You are the rabbi. Classically, of course, the rabbi of the town gave the drushas and helped the people, and he passed in the shilas. So that wasn't the main role was the halachic guidance for the town. So he says, we want you to start passing some shilas. So he said, okay, I'll do my best. I'll try to pass in the shilas. So the next shilah that came up in the town was Anida shila, and the woman like she was used to doing with Reb Simcha Zelig, showed the shaila, whatever it was, to Reb Simcha Zelig's wife anonymously, I guess, and then Reb Simcha Zelig would show it to him or discuss it with him, whatever, and he would tell his wife the answer, then his wife would tell the lady the answer. So this woman thought, okay, Reb Chaim's going to start answering the shailas now, so I'm going to do it the same way. So she took it. She took the shaila to Reb Chaim's wife, and Reb Chaim's wife came and told Reb Chaim the shaila. He says, I need much more information. I can't paskin just based on this. I need to speak with a woman. So they brought the woman, and he said, well, was it like this or was it like this? And did you have this type of hargasha or this type of hargasha and this and that? And they were grilling her in all these potential aspects of what the shaila might be. And then they decided that they were going to just go back to asking all the shailas to Reb Simcha Zelig. I mean, the situation in Breuer's here is a little different. The Rav answers shailas also, but they have, I don't know what the Dayan did traditionally. I know the years ago he was in charge of kashrus, because most of the things were in Washington Heights. So the Dayan was just an extra halachic person on hand. Again, not to replace the rabbi, but just to be second, to be subservient to the rabbi, but more just, because the rabbi has other duties, yeah, to be a halachic, another halachic voice, yeah?
But also, it used to be that you had something called a shtat rav, something like that. Something
right.
Like, say, Aruch HaShulchan,
Sure.
But now, the Rosh Yeshivas basically have taken upon themselves all the responsibilities of not only, running yeshivas, but being the post game. How is that?
Right. Right. That's an issue. Some people feel that since the Rosh Yeshiva are, in the Arba Amos of the base Medrash all day, they're not as engaged with the real world, as therefore they're not necessarily the most suited to passing shalas. They're more going with a pure, mm-hmm. idealistic conception of halacha. I mean, for the most part, we can pretty much manage with the real world. I mean, there are Rosh Yeshiva, especially in YU, are rabbis also. Rabbi Willig, Rabbi Neuberger, all these different types of, all these different Rosh Yeshiva are also Rabbanim. Right, but you have a principle, you have a phenomenon that nowadays there's a decline of the local rabbi. We don't have Shtarov, like they used to. They used to be the city or the town, they had a rabbi, and the rabbi controlled everything in the town. The only place where they sort of have a remnant of that in America is Elizabeth. Elizabeth in New Jersey, although nowadays the system even there is somewhat breaking down. They still have someone who's officially the rabbi of the town, but there are many, each shul has its own rabbi, and they're pretty independent from what I understand. In the olden days you had really, really great people who were local rabbis, like Reb Lazer Silver was not Rosh Hashiva. Reb Lazer Silver was... for a time. He was the greatest Torah scholar in America, probably, and he was a shul rabbi in Cincinnati. Cincinnati. What great rabbanim live in Cincinnati nowadays? And with all the respect to the rabbanim in Cincinnati, I don't think any of them are of the stature of anywhere near Reb Lazer Silver anymore. So that was a different time. So nowadays there's been a change of approach that nowadays the Rosh Yeshiva are viewed as the real authorities, and the local shul rabbis, even to a certain extent in the yeshivish world, are viewed more as a gateway, or perhaps just a local person to ask, more simpler shailas to, are not really viewed as Torah leaders. Or as Rabbi Bleich would say, I once interviewed him for a project, for a class about American rabbinate. So he says that nowadays, a lot of shul rabbis are really just religious social workers. They're not really rabbanim.
No, that's true.
And he's right. It's a problem that really we have, to a certain extent, lowered our standards for who qualifies as a shul rabbi. It's not good that a shul rabbi really should be at least some level of halachic authority.
Also because you can always leapfrog over your local rabbi by email or by,
Right, that's like also that, a problem nowadays, yeah.
But if your shul rabbi is basically a religious social worker and you have a heavy-duty shiloh, maybe you really need to leapfrog.
No, the point is you shouldn't. He should understand which point, where he should in fact direct the shiloh.
Although if he really is just a religious social worker and not a rav, then he might not understand at what point that he should no longer be taking responsibility for the shilohs. But ideally, if you have a rav who knows somewhat what he's doing and not totally just a religious social worker, then yes, you should, ideally, all the shilas you should take to him first, and then he'll leapfrog for you or go with you, help you, facilitate your leapfrogging to discuss it with the greater halachic authority. Yes?
This is a very American
thing. Yeah.
I mean, in the general world, there's not always in maybe the Catholics less than the Protestants, but there's a lot of that out. That's how they do it in America. Guy's a pastor. Shul rabbis don't.
Right, that's what Rabbi Bleich told me. That's based on the model of the Protestant clergy.
Yeah.
That they preach. They're preachers. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And
social. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mentioned the course of this. I said we mentioned something about a Jewish community, which a very large Jewish community with many shuls and many rabbis. So he said. So I said, well, the rabbanim there, so he said, no, there are no rabbanim there. They're all, they're rabbis there, but don't make a mistake. There are no rabbanim in that community. To a certain extent, he's right. So you have, and you have even in American rabbinate, you have a very big difference of level of learning among shul rabbis. Some are really not that knowledgeable, and some are, and then you have shuls where Rabbi Willig is the rabbi. So you have a really big variety. Umei Masai, Chayev Lamod Mipnei Rabo Mnei Chacham Acher. Again, we discussed this before. When do you have to stand up before your personal Rebbe Muvak and more before a different Chacham? So if it's your Rebbe Muvak, so you have as soon as you see him, you have to stand up. And for another Chacham, just when he gets in your Abamos of Eze Makom of Eze Inyan Pater Min Akima. At what point are you not required to stand up for the any Chacham? So if you're in the bathroom or in a bathhouse, then you don't have to stand up for the your Rebbe. So you're not supposed to go into the bathhouse with your Rebbe at the same time, unless he needs
you. Enter at the same time,
right? You're not supposed to be. No, I mean this is talking about a time, obviously, where you're in the bathhouse, you're just sitting there, and your Rebbe comes in. Oh, awkward. But that's not. But you're not really supposed to plan to go into the bathhouse at the same time as your Rebbe, unless he needs you to serve him. Let's say your Rebbe is elderly and frail, and he needs you to escort him from from the pools to the sauna to the to the massage area.
You're supposed to see your Rebbe without clothes on. That's right. Yeah.
Right, unless he needs you to mishamish him. Right.
Is this pretty common knowledge?
What?
Is this pretty common knowledge?
Yes.
Then okay.
Okay, we're not going to.
We will bracket the comments.
Yeah, that's a different issue because there is that din that you're supposed to maintain a dignified image of your Rebbe. That's why.
So before Yom and Rhyme, they have separate hours for.
Well, here, at the mikveh here, they have separate rooms for rabbis, yeah. Probably, I mean, just the stomach of it, but also for that reason. But the other mikveh, what's it called? The Dumbrov. So then you have just one room, so everybody's together. Most mikvahs are... Anyway, so that is a din that not only completely naked, but you're not supposed to see the rabbi
in his bathing trunks.
Right, in an undignified manner of dress. So there was an issue. I heard about this, that there was a Rosh Yeshiva somewhere, interesting character, not a traditional Haredi Rosh Yeshiva, shall we say, who used to go jogging with a t-shirt and shorts around the neighborhood where he has his yeshiva. So they said to him, you know, sure, Rosh Yeshiva should be doing that. He said, oh, there's no din. If you're jogging, you're allowed to wear this dress. Yes, if you're a regular person, that's worth to discuss. But Rosh Yeshiva should not appear in public like that. Period. It's not a din in how you dress for exercise versus other things. It's supposed to, people are not supposed to have an image of you in their heads of anything but being in a manner of dignified dress. My grandfather-in-law was very makbid on this. Mm. He said that he would always he would not go out, leave his house without a tie. Mm-hmm. He would not. So there was actually one time. So my grandmother-in-law was, you know, when they moved to Florida, you know, he was a rabbi in Ohio. Mm-hmm. He was a rabbi in Dayton, Ohio. So he was not. He was nowhere, and he was in Florida, so they retired to Florida, or they were on vacation in Florida. So she said to him, oh, come on, you can take off your tie. You know, it's Florida, you know, relax, no one's going to, you're not going to. He takes off his tie, they went for a short walk around the block, and, oh, Rabbi Fox, oh, it's so nice to see you. Oh, and no tie, wow, you're really loose here. And he said, that's it. Never again. Again, I don't know if it's halachically required. It depends on the community exactly what standard of dress you have to maintain. But the rabbi wants to work out, so he can work out in the privacy of his home, or go to the gym where that's expected dress, and you shouldn't expect not a gym where he doesn't expect to run into any congregants. Or students, whatever. It is allowed, but. Something you indeed have to make sure. But yes, Rube. Oh, so also if you're in the middle of your work, so you're not allowed to take off time from your work to stand up for somebody that you're supposed to stand up for because you're stealing from the person for whom you're working, the Baal HaBayis. All the many details about this, the kiddushin perishin become a sacherim. In the Maseches Kiddushin, v'chein b'dini ha-mitzvah ha-inyonim shepotchim mehem ha-chachomim mitzad kivodam u-moram. Oh, there are certain things from which you exempt Talmidei Chachomim. K'yon b'inyonim v'chafiros ha-medina v'chayotze b'hen. Let's say you have public works projects that everybody is expected to participate in. So the Talmidei Chachomim do not have to participate because it's not considered dignified for their status to do so. V'chein ha-misim shematil ha-namlachim al-anshei haretz. So sometimes there are taxes that are levied in a country, bein mashu kotzuv al kol b'nei ha'ir yachad, o shehu kotzuv al kol ish v'ish, o she'enu kotzuv klal, mikol zehem peturim. So they're exempt from taxes. So whether or not, so sometimes...
Can you persuade, like, the Tsar, you know, about this distinction, or...
So we see here there's a distinction between taxes. Sometimes the king used to impose a tax on the entire Jewish community. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he would impose a tax on each person individually. So that Sefer HaChinuch here presents the majority shita that the Talmidei Chachamim are always exempt and the other people have to cover for the Talmidei Chachamim. But there are shitas that say, no, they're only exempt from the tax that are levied on the entire Jewish community, for example, around this entire town that in which the Talmidei Chachamim live, they would be exempt from that. Other people have to cover, but if it's on each person individually, then they would, in fact, have to pay. So I don't think this will work out exactly.
The IRS would not do it.
Right, the IRS wouldn't necessarily go for this. I mean, the Jewish community could cover for those people. Yeah. Or in Israel, of course, you have a whole segment of the population that doesn't pay much tax because they're learning all the time and they don't make money. So they'll say, well, this is the din. We're the Talmidei Chachamim. We're not supposed to pay taxes, so that the rest of the population who are working, who are not religious, whatever, should pay our taxes for us. So on a small scale, maybe they're correct, but the question is, when you're a third of the country, or however many people are doing this nowadays, so it doesn't work like that. The whole system doesn't work. It only works when there's this very small number of people who are doing it. Shenemar gam ki snu bagoyim ato kabtzeim v'yachilu me'ad mimasa melech v'sarim. So there's a pasuk that says, it's not a simple understanding of the pasuk. It says when they're dispersed in the nations, I'm going to gather them, and if it's just a small amount, then they're going to be relieved from the burden of the king. So obviously this pasuk doesn't necessarily, it's really unclear what it's really referring to, but the Chazal take it to mean yishnu, like in Aramaic. That means if they learn. So if they learn amongst the goyim, so I'm going to gather them, and if it's only some of them, ma'at, then they're going to be relieved from the burden of a king and officers, that they're not going to have to pay all the taxes. And I guess b'chol mak or b'chol zman b'zchar menakevos, in all place and all place times males and females. Again, okay, the classical sources means that the females have to honor the Torah scholars. It doesn't mean that female Torah scholars should be honored. But we pointed out last time that maybe nowadays, since women are recognized as having the potential to become wiser and more learned than they used to, then we should give honor to female scholars as well, again, who do it in an appropriate and Yirah Shemayim Dikah manner. The over alea, because if not, then they said even somebody who's who doesn't live properly. So even if they know shas bal peh, you don't give them any honor at all, even a man. And if it's a woman, of course. So if you're a woman, if she's elderly, then you stand up anyway. The over, because that's not dependent on Torah knowledge per se. The over alea bitel asay v'onsho gadol. It's a very great punishment if you neglect to fulfill this commandment. L'man ki zeh yisod chazak badas. It's very important in the in religion, that people should stand up for those who honor the religion, or represent the religion, rather. Mitzvah Reish Nun Ches, Mitzvah 258, Shelola Honos B'midos V'chol Hamidos B'chlal. Not to cheat regarding weights and measures, and all of the weights and measures are included in this. That we should not cheat at all regarding measures of liquid and dry, or weight. Same thing when you're surveying land and measuring land. Shouldn't cheat at all. Anything that's measured. Sizes of clothes. You should not pervert the set ways, the justice. Bemida, measurement, bemishkal, with a weight, uve mesura, a small volume of measurement. Uperisho zichron levracha, ki mesura, he midas halach v'hayavish. So mesura is a measurement of volume. V'hi mida ktana bioser. It's really small. Shehi echad milamed gimel belug. So it's 1/33 of a lug. It's very small. Nevertheless, the Torah specifically singles it out that you shouldn't cheat regarding that. So it means that even the tiniest measurement, you shouldn't be cavalier and say,
this is why it's not subsumed within the prohibition against theft.
It's right. It's an extra chizuk to the prohibition against theft. Right. That's a good point. Exactly the relationship of this to the prohibition of theft. So if a lug is 300 milliliters divided by 33, so it's 9 milliliters.
Half a fluid ounce. Right.
So a mesura is in fact very small. Right, but although in terms of stealing, even less than shvei pruta is still usser. You don't have the chiyuv to return it.
Well, if you
v'lomadnu mikan ki haTorah hikpido al hamidos b'chol shehu. The Torah requires us to be careful about measurements, even the tiniest amount. Kilomar shafal pishe b'shar gizel also sakbid haTorah al b'pruta. That the Torah is not really considered stealing unless you do a pruta, even though you're not allowed to steal even less than a pruta. But the main prohibition is only in effect when you steal a pruta, you have to give it back, etc. Binyamidos takbi b'chol shehu. So it's a full violation, even if you don't, even if you shave off the tiniest amount from all these midos. Perush hakosuv kein lo sasu avel ba mishpat umahu hamishpat hashanu ikan. What's mishpat, justice, over here? That somebody who measures stuff is called a judge. What does that mean? It's as if you're a judge that perverted justice in a court case. The Kori Ovel Meshukatz Cherim V'Soeva, all these bad words, abomination, you know, disgusting, perversion. The Gorim Lachamisha Dvarim Hamurim Badayan. So the same thing that we have very harsh words to say about a judge who perverts justice. The same thing goes over here. Metame Asaretz, you impurify the land. Mechalas Hashem, you you denigrate the name of God. Umasalek es Hashchina, then you cause the divine presence to depart. Umapil es Yisrael becherev, and you cause the Jewish people to be subjugated with a sword. Umegala osam yartzam, you cause exile. Woo! Really bad stuff that you think would be limited to a judge. It's not. It's even if you.
Again, I don't quite understand, why is it that of all the various forms of cheating, that, you know, having short waits is...
Because it's the most subtle. You think you can get away with it the most easily. So you have extra prohibitions to strengthen your commitment to it. The punishment is greater than that of the sexual impropriety types of relationships. Okay, it's not meant literally, but they're trying to make a point here. So zeh bein adam lamakom, zeh bein ol chaveros. So arayos is between man and God, and this is between two human beings. Shorish a mitzvah yadua, kemo shekasavti lamala b'mitzvah saseh yud beiv b'seir hazeh, which again in our editions comes next, but it can, the original version of Sefer Chinuch came before.